as far as I'm concerned, as long as that same respect and recognition is not shown toward every one of our people in this country, it doesn't exist for me. And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. Us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Welcome back to another episode of The Malcolm Effect, and joining me today is, I'm truly blessed and fortunate to be able to call this individual a friend, a brother, a comrade, a teacher. I've been trying to get them on for such a long time, but they have been avoiding me and ducking me, but they finally agreed to come on the show and bless us and grace us with their presence. So thank you so much and welcome. Long overdue to the first time on The Malcolm Effect, Professor Zahir Kolia. How are you?
No, I'm doing well. I'm so blessed to be here. Thank you so much. Yeah, I've been wanting to come on for a long time. And there's so many different things I suppose we could, that we want to talk about and stuff. But I'm excited for this one.
I'm really excited. And I know my listeners will be aware that I have moved into more of a series, right? Three-part series, because as much as, you know, one conversation is good, but to really dive into the issues and have a conversation, I think it requires a few conversations. So this is going to be a topic that both of us find dear to our research interests and dear to ourselves as individuals, as we will be discussing the questions of theology and modernity and the theological underpinnings of modernity. So before we go into like the plan of the episode and I ask more like substantive questions, my first question is to let us audience know, so what is it about these questions that intrigue you, and how did you arrive that you find yourself researching these questions and asking these questions?
Yeah, in the broadest sense, and I'll get into it with my background, I suppose, being in post-colonial theory, which I guess the Marxist-Leninists will cringe a little bit with that, right? And then my background also being in like decolonial theory, and then also gravitating towards world systems theory. The question of the theological was never really adequately taken up in the broadest sense, right? And 1492, which we're going to talk about, becomes really, really important to the story. And I think my interest in it was the way 1492 was really being framed, particularly around the Americas. And so, you know, if we start in 1492 Americas, for me, and that was a lot of the emphasis with especially decolonial theory, I think what I found, we're really mistaking an intensification for the point at which imperialism suddenly appears. And what it seemed to me is that what appears as a sudden rupture is in fact the outward expansion of structures related to conquest already being forged within Iberia itself and what today is basically Spain and Portugal. And also back in like 2012, I did a Islamic decolonial theology course, met a lot of really cool people, and that helped me also set some of the connections to thinking about these broader questions around imperialism, modernity, and theology.
Thank you so much for that response. And I think oftentimes, I mean, people will be familiar, obviously on this show, we talk about imperialism a lot. But I think oftentimes missing from our discussion, and I think October the 7th has been a watershed moment because we had so many people asking the question, there has to be something that keeps the Palestinians so steadfast. And I think we tell an incomplete story of modernity and how modernity unfolds when we don't reckon with the theological questions. So that's why I'm really excited to have this conversation and this series. I'm not trying to proselytize, but I do think it's important that we talk about theology and the theological underpinnings of modernity to understand motivations, to understand how a belief in God or a particular understanding of a religion orients you in particular modalities and ways of being in the world and ways of relationality as well. So my first question for you, Professor Kolia, why start with medieval Iberia to understand imperialism?
Yeah, I think like I mentioned, like really the short answer is starting 1492 Americas, you're really going to mistake something important. And I think it's coming to thinking medieval Iberia in 1492, but going a little bit earlier, opens a question to thinking about sovereignty and asking why sovereignty is theological in its origins. And if we ask that question, it really opens up a pathway to think about, for me anyways, conquest. And sovereignty does not precede conquest, but rather it's being like constituted through it. So we can think about conquest as something buried in the past, but reworking Patrick Wolf a little bit, we can say conquest is a structure, not an event. So that means it's not just a moment that happened and happened once and just ended. It's a way of organizing life, power, economics, and knowledge that continue to shape how our world works today. And when we think about conquest, I wanted to just be very clear. It's not simply stating that the non-West was simply acted upon. But for me, when I think about conquest, it also includes translation, appropriation, and the reorganization of knowledge and practice into imperial forms that then present themselves as being universal. So when we think about the fall of Andalus in 1492, it marks a lot more than the end of Muslim rule in Iberia, what's today basically Spain and Portugal. What it does, for me, it signals the formation of a theological imperial structure that links Christian doctrine, imperial sovereignty, and the emergence of a global order. And these effects really do remain with us. And to address all of this, like, I'm hoping your listeners will be patient and you'll be patient with me, because I think before really getting into thinking about medieval Iberia in 1492, like, I feel like working through several frameworks is important. So, you know, working through Anthony Angi's work, working through ideas on sovereignty, decolonial theory, as I mentioned, and world system analysis before we really get into it. And I think from sort of that point and thinking about some of your previous episodes and thinking about Bikram stuff around imperialism and the denial of sovereignty, I think that's like maybe a good way to enter the conversation.
I agree.
Yeah.
So carry on. Let's go into that frameworks, right? Let's go into those frameworks. So when you are approaching this question of theology and modernity, who are your interlocutors and what are some of the theories?
Yeah. So entering into it, if we're going to pivot off the question about imperialism being about the denial of sovereignty, and folks can obviously listen to that one. I think for me, and where it brings us to the different frameworks and the lens to think about that, is that the question is, like, how did Europeans come to imagine sovereignty in a way that made this denial both thinkable and even necessary? And I think for a lot of folks, it's not enough just to say that Europeans simply believed that other people were inferior, and therefore you could deny other people's sovereignty. Because ideas just don't fall from the sky. Like, people, did they just wake up one day and decide to deny other people's sovereignty? And I don't think, I'm not saying Bikram makes this simplistic intervention. He goes obviously much deeper. But I think folks often, especially in some mainstream decolonial trends, will take this as an assumption. And I don't think that's enough to really just start with the notion that Europeans believed others were inferior and therefore you deny their sovereignty. And I think to give an answer like that would be something more like akin to an answer like Hegel may give, right? Like, history as a pure folding of pure ideas. And that really misses a point. And I think really to understand imperialism, and it's like we have to ask, like, what historical material and theological conditions make the denial of sovereignty really thinkable in the first place. And so getting into the frameworks, I think it will be useful to go through Anthony Angi's work. And I think his work on sovereignty.
So even before we get there, let's even have a more of a basic question for the listeners. Mm. When you say theology, when you say the theological question, what do we mean?
Yeah, so typically theology will be formally thinking about, like, the nature of God, the existence of God, God's attributes. When I'm thinking about it in this context, I'm thinking about it not so much in that formal discussion, but thinking about it maybe more slightly as a branch of, like, political theology. So how religion as a concept emerges much later on, and Talal Asad's work indexes that. And it comes entwined with colonialism as well. But thinking about how theological questions, like questions about the human, the nature of even time, around the nature of the end of times, like eschatology, these things really entwine with how people are viewing political questions and different questions around human variation, connections between folks. So you have Christians encountering Muslims, encountering multiple different types of people, and the vocabularies and the lenses they use are very much structured through through Christian theology, right? And so those questions, especially when we're looking at this particular time, we can't use a secular lens and then view backwards just to view all of these processes that unfolded from this time as just unfolding for material interest within a secular frame, right? Or to look back at just say modern bioevolutionary notions of race and then to read it back and to say these folks were just operating through racial categories to understand sovereignty. I think one has to really account for, again, those theological questions, those religious questions about the human, the nature of life, the nature of existence, meaning those things become the foundation through which people are viewing the world and how they encounter difference.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the story of 1492, 15th century more broadly. We see there are sets and series of processes in which Europe is responding to. And then we see after that, the kind of birth of the Westphalian state, modern state system, in which there's a declaration of, you know, a respect for sovereign territorial boundaries, right? But then we also understand through the work of Anthony Angi that sovereignty or sovereign doctrine, also with Sebra Grovegi, it has this kind of metamorphosis of that when it reaches the peripheries or when it reaches the third world, it becomes something else. Its actualization is only through a particular type of domination. But I think before we even talk about the encounter, do you want to unpack a little bit for the listeners? What is taking place in Europe at this time before the kind of age of discovery?
So before we have the age of discovery, yeah, I think that's to work into that question about Europe being like a completely, like a peripheral situation. I think getting to that place, it's useful maybe before that to work through the decolonial and the world systems folks, because that sets the stage to really think about that moment, but and to work through Angie a bit. But I mean, it's up to you. Do you want me to think, to go through that sort of material context of what was happening before 1492 and in that era?
Yeah, I think that would be good if that's possible. I think that would be just to kind of give people context.
Okay, so to give people like a slight context. Okay, so I get like long before 1492, and I'll come back to this with regards to world systems analysis and decolonial theory, that we have to understand that like Christian Europe, the idea of even Europe hadn't emerged, right? So this we're using this term as a category to be a little bit more intelligible, but long before 1492, Christian Europe was not the center of anything. It was really like a poor, crisis-ridden corner of a much larger Afro-Eurasian world that was still dominated by Islamic, African, and Asian powers. So late medieval Europe went through what is described as a feudal crisis. So you had population decline, you had reoccurring famines, peasant uprisings, declining feudal revenues. And so it was a world where the old agrarian and feudal arrangements were coming under just like enormous strain, right? And so Iberia sits inside of that story. And as I mentioned, Iberia is just like a geographic location, basically Spain and Portugal. And I'm going to mention Castile and Aragon, which are really important players in this. And they're two really powerful medieval kingdoms within Iberia. So today they're regions within Spain, but they're not separate kingdoms. And what we see well before 1492 is that Castile and Aragon, it didn't enter the 15th century as strong industrial powers. They lacked significant manufacturing capacity. So in world systems terms, they belong to the semi-periphery. They're plugged into wider trade networks, but they're dependent on wealth and institutions generated elsewhere. And this is where Andalus really matters. And so much of Christian Europe is basically struggling with these feudal contradictions, Andalus was tied to Sudanic gold routes. Funneling through West Africa, you had gold through what is today like Mauritania, Algeria, and it was flowing into the Mediterranean. And that gold really sustained a vibrant Mediterranean commercial economy that linked North Africa, the Western Sudan, the Islamicate, and eventually European markets. So where the feudal crisis hit other regions hard, Andalus was really at least partially isolated from this. On top of that, when we think about this sort of moment where what is understood as Europe being put in these different feudal crises and decline, we have from roughly the 8th to the 11th centuries, you have really expert Muslim horticulturalists and farmers. So we have both small and large scale agricultural expertise, and they engineered an agricultural revolution in Iberia. And they introduced and refined irrigation systems, new crops, hydraulic technologies like animal driven water wheels, and built really dense networks between cities and the surrounding countryside. So when the Christian kingdoms start to advance south, they're not just conquering, you know, Muslim territory in a really abstract sense. They're really trying to solve a material problem, right? And because they're not at the center of anything, as I mentioned. And so they're really trying to target a region that has already high yield agriculture, sophisticated irrigation infrastructure, well-developed road and market networks, and key access to gold routes that connect them to a wider set of world economies. So the conquest of Andalus is not only about expelling Islam. It's really about seizing land and redirecting an existing infrastructure of wealth. When we think about that, the Christian monarchs at this time, when they start to conquer Andalus in light of this wider feudal crisis that's plaguing Europe, they have three different options that they could take. And the first one is they could learn and maintain Muslim irrigation systems and mixed agriculture. Two, they can impose Northern European dry farming techniques. And three, they can abandon this intensive agriculture altogether in favor of large-scale sheep herding, seasonal sheep herding. And what Castile does is they really prioritize the third option. And so what they do is sheep herding becomes the really dominant mode of economic dependence in the central meseta, which is like Spain's vast interior plateau. Mm-hmm. And so they're also, their irrigated land gets converted into pasture. And Brodel like reminds us, he says, like, this only makes sense in the larger context of wider European crisis. Depressed wool prices, a slowdown of English exports, and a strong Italian cloth industry that really wants raw materials. So the frontier with Andalus becomes a way for the semi-peripheral kingdom to try to plug itself into these markets. So the conquest of Andalus before, when we're thinking about this, are trying to do two things, right? Internally, it's trying to transform the agrarian regime and building up a pastoral export economy. Externally, it's trying to give Iberia a way to climb out of its peripheral status by tapping into trade circuits and gold flows previously anchored in Muslim Spain. So this is where, when thinking about Andalus in the context through which it, why it's important, I think that's in part sort of the material basis of why and what was happening beforehand.
And I think that's important, right? Because I think you're situating and locating us in, you know, a phenomenon does not just emerge out of thin air, right? No people are ever abstracted from history. So I appreciate laying out that context. So let's open up and work through some of these frameworks, right? You mentioned Angi, you've mentioned decolonial theory. Let's work through them, right? So let's start off with Angi and then we'll go to decolonial. So with Angi now, first, so I guess the question is, how do you use Angi? How do you read Angi? And what does Angi do for your work as well?
Yeah, Angi was really like, the first thing that really stood out to me when I read Angi, and we'll get into it, is more how he humanizes indigenous people and how he ends up at colonial violent forms of domination through humanization and not the typical story of just like constituting indigenous peoples as subhuman, that therefore that authorizes the denial of their sovereignty and forms of violent colonialism, right? That was one of the first things that stood out to me. And then
why is that important for you?
It was important for me in a few different ways. Like, I think dealing and talking about some of these questions with students over the years, I think for a lot of them, when they think about colonialism, it almost has become, for a lot of these students, like formulaic. And the formula that they seem to have in mind is, you have, okay, Europeans are like characterized, or dominant strands of it get characterized through like white supremacy. That then translates into a form of understanding the other, whichever group one wants to think about, as subhuman, and therefore that authorizes a form of imperialism, and they end up, you know, exploiting labor, extracting resources, and colonizing territories. And so when students approach these questions, like, they often approach it with that logic, which is almost like mathematical, right? And then when students then go to a solution, and this is the important thing for Angi here in your question, is that for them, a lot of the times the solution is, okay, if the non-European is understood as subhuman, then we need to understand them as human. And I'll often have students fall on like a colorblind, really liberal set of ideas, right? That if we can just understand everyone as human, like, I don't see color, I just see human beings, then we're gonna actually unlock the key to forms of imperialism and Western domination. And reading Angi, I think, is important because it's like, look, if you want to start with the question of humanizing the non-European, you can still get and land on the exact same place of like butchering, violence, resource extraction, territorial expropriation. Like you can get to the same thing. And I think for students, when I teach this, they often miss that part of it and how it can come through that vector, a moral vector of sort of humanizing the non-Western subject.
Yeah, nah, I do. I think that's important, actually. Okay. But I think a question that is somewhat axiomatic then, after laying out historical context and the work that Angie does in undoing, there's something central to Europe and the politics of Europe that create particular forms of relationality as it pertains to sovereign. A question then is, though, we know that there are theological debates and differences, right? We know the story of Dominican and Franciscan and Vittoria as well. So I guess, how are you reading these figures and how do they sample when you're thinking about these questions?
Yeah, so let me go, and it'll tie to your previous question too, right? Like, so thinking about Angie maybe questioning and how he calls into question the Westphalian sort of myth, and then to get into these questions that you're asking now, like what were some of the theological underpinnings of just say Vittoria's thought, and then how they're understanding human variation and how this impacts this notion of sovereignty and imperialism, right? And so I think like Angie shows that the usual Westphalian story, that's to say like sovereignty first, colonialism later, he's saying this framing gets it completely backwards, right? So international law and the sovereignty doctrine didn't expand fully formed in Europe, and it wasn't just applied outward. So it emerged from Europe's attempts to classify and manage issues around human variation. And really fundamentally jurisdiction. And what you get, you ultimately dominate peoples that cannot mutually recognize as equals. So sovereignty, as we know it, comes into being through the colonial encounter. And once we see that, this is for me where the theological dimension becomes unavoidable, right? The very distinction between mm-hmm. who could be seen as sovereign and who could not was articulated through Christian categories of reason, salvation, law, and just war, right? And so Angie gives us a way to really excavate how theology, law, and imperial power crystallize together at the birth of modern international order. So when we think mm-hmm. about this, the theological question, that becomes key. And Angie makes just like a really, I would say, simple but powerful argument, right? He's like, we can't understand the modern idea of sovereignty, the very foundations of international law, without looking at its colonial and, again, its theological roots, right? So the traditional story that we know, and this is the one that we question, international law is about creating order among already existing sovereign states. Supposedly began in Europe mm-hmm. with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, and then it gets extended to the colonies, right? And this is what you alluded to earlier. And so in that view, imperialism is just more of a side episode, something that happened after sovereignty was already established. And Angie, why he's so, I think, compelling is that Angie, he flips it. He just says, no, like international law wasn't created to manage relations among equals. It was born through the colonial encounter, through conquest, in an effort to define and control those who are not recognized as sovereign. And with that, he uses that dynamic of difference, this constant distinction between civilized and uncivilized mm-hmm. is really what produces sovereignty. And for me, the thing is, Vittoria is so fascinating because he stands really at a historical threshold. And this will cut into your question a little bit more directly because he's a Dominican theologian. And he's really trying to understand and figure out how Christian Europe should legally and morally respond to the so-called discovery of the New World, which at this point happened about 40 years prior. So Angie doesn't really emphasize this, but what I really want to emphasize to your listeners is that Vittoria was part of the Dominican order. And this is so important. And I think very much neglected, right? So Dominican theology, it really reshaped the grounds on which Spain could claim authority over indigenous peoples. And Dominicans, they're named after Dominic de Guzman. And it's a Christian order grounded in scholastic reason, the Salamanca school, natural law, and also the thought of Aquinas and Augustine. And so what does that mean exactly? I mean, scholastic reason is the medieval method of using Aristotelian philosophy to interpret and organize Christian theology. So what that means is that these Christian thinkers like Vittoria, they weren't just trying to use preaching theology and just talking about the nature of God and you just have to accept it. They're like, look, we need to actually use rigorous logic and systematic argumentation as opposed to just this method of narrating the gospel. Right. And so this becomes really important. And this is where you get sort of that juridical focus with Vittoria that's really important. And then the School of Salamanca, mm-hmm. it's not so much a formal school, like with the manifesto, but more of, you can think about more of a movement. And it was really by a bunch of theologians trying to address really new political, moral, and legal challenges that arose around the time that they're living. So you have the conquest of Andalusia, which culminates in the fall of Granada in 1492. You have the expulsion of Jews and Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula, and they're having to use legal arguments to think through that. And then, of course, the so-called discovery of the Americas, right? And so with that, and because Vitoria then is a Dominican, he's really fascinating in this regard. And this is where his Dominican orientation becomes really key here, because he rejects like apocalyptic conquests as a legitimate source of authority. And this is really opposed to Franciscans, who I'll mention. It'll become really important in the next like episode when we're talking about Columbus. Mm-hmm. Right. And so Vitoria locates Spanish rights not so much in a divine mandate, right, but in universally shared natural rights. The example of traveling, sojourning, or settling, engaging in commerce, and preaching the gospel. And Vitoria does something like, the thing that's really interesting for me too when I read him first is that he rejects papal decrees. Like, he denies that the Pope ever had temporal jurisdiction over non-Christians using divine law.
Mm.
Right. And so divine law is what governs relations between Christians and non-Christians. And that was already being put in place through like the Crusades and stuff. Right. So what Vitoria does is that he argues that imperial intervention is not justified because indigenous peoples need Christian salvation. He says it's because imperial like intervention is justified because they're said to have violated universal legal norms. Right. And so as a result, like, he's very different from Columbus, who is a Franciscan. And Franciscans are named after Francis of Assisi, and they're an order linked to Christian apocalyptic spirituality, which within itself is a really fascinating and important strand, I think, of Western imperialism and the theological dimensions of it, which we'll talk about after. Right. And Franciscans, especially this figure called Joachim of Fiore, who Columbus drew from heavily, he writes like a bunch of different like prophecies, and it's really rooted, conquest is really rooted in apocalyptic eschatology and what's called sacramental urgency. So meaning mass conversion of the so-called non-Christian heathen becomes a sign of the end of times. It's part of their eschatology, their idea of the end of the world. But Dominicans, like, they're different, and they're rooted in the evaluation of conquest and natural law, rational capacity, and the limits of sovereign power. So Dominican theology operated with really a different set of assumptions. But the thing that's so important is that they ultimately end up endorsing Spanish imperialism. They arrive there through like a different circuit than the Franciscans and mm-hmm. someone like Columbus. Like, forced conversion is invalid. War cannot be justified to spread faith, and evangelization like has to follow persuasion and not conquest. And also, this is really important for understanding Las Casas, because he's also Dominican. Right. And so he ends up also authorizing Spanish imperialism by, you know, humanizing indigenous peoples. And he's often propped up, and in my classes, even in grad school, people would often raise him as a counterpoint, right? To be like, well, not all Europeans were bad. You had Las Casas mm-hmm. humanizing and defending indigenous peoples, right? And so that's the point that I was getting to connected to earlier too, where students often fall on this idea where like humanizing becomes the answer to opposing colonial capitalist relations, but it's not. Like, you can humanize and end up in the very same place, right? You get there through a different circuit, but that's key to understand. So anyway, so with Dominicans and Franciscans, like, their two theological lineages, these two Christian orders, like, really profoundly shaped early Western imperialist thought and practice, right? And so that sort of going into that little sidebar, which I think is so key, like, when we think about Vitoria as a Dominican, like, he's thinking about jurisdiction quite heavily because of the things I just mentioned, right? He's not just thinking, okay, they're non-Christian, therefore we have mm-hmm. a divine mandate to Christianize and convert them and take their stuff, right? Like, he's thinking about the novelty of so-called discovery. And he's writing and sort of paraphrasing here. He's like, Indians of the New World had never been known before to our world. And he's thinking through this, I think, in a sincere way. Right. And then for him, this is like an entirely new situation that traditional forms of divine and canon law can't handle. Right. So just for your listener, like, divine law is unchanging mm-hmm. moral, like unchanging moral will revealed to humanity by God. And canon law is like church's changeable legal system. And he's saying these two forms of law, which have really long histories, he's like, they don't really apply here. And so partly why he's so important and fascinating, like, he clears the ground for an entirely new type of law. and it's a universal natural law, again, influenced by his Dominican orientation, that could apply to all humans by reason. And that's where, just gentium, the law of nations. And this move is so crucial because this is where, like, so-called secular international law, it really emerges within a theological framework. And so Vittoria's importance here, it's that he really develops a set of ideas that shape how Western powers authorize domination right up to the present, right? And he really universalizes Western practices as the norm. If you've colonized folks, like, want recognition, they have to conform to European standards of law, reason, and civilization. And again, it's not the typical story of just dehumanizing indigenous people, right? He humanizes them to an extent. And it's through their humanization, they claim that they have the capacity for reason, that domination becomes thinkable and actually enforceable.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that becomes really important.
Mm. No, absolutely. And I think these are some of the, you get the liberal accounts of these stories, right? I remember growing up in school, similar. It was like, oh, Europe did some bad stuff, but then William Wilberforce came along and, we don't have scientific racism anymore. And, but I don't think that gets into, like, the categories. And I think I really look forward to speaking about secularism as we go forward as well, 'cause I know that's connected as well. But bringing back to for today's focus, okay, so let's talk about, we mentioned Angi, you mentioned the theological differences. I think what was striking to me in that, the differences of theology still culminated in a justification of colonialism. So how do we understand that? Like, how do we understand that they're different? Some humanize, some say they didn't have the ability to reason, but then they both justify and accept colonization of the other.
Yeah, so like with Angi's work and looking at Vittoria in particular, right, he's saying, okay, he insists that they're human, that they possess reason, and this is precisely why they're bound by jus gentium or the law of nations, right? And because they have reason, they have to allow the Spanish to travel, sojourn, trade, and preach the gospel. And they're reading this through, like Vittoria and others are reading this in relation to the account of Noah's flood. The flood and Noah's ark, and the idea is that, the violation, it would be a violation not at those times not to allow others to travel and trade and sojourn. And so you're getting this, the emergence of secular international law becoming the outcome of a reconfigured set of Christian theological understandings and ideas, right? And so what happens, and I think the thing that's really important is, like, Vittoria almost sounds, and I think people can misread it, is that it kind of sounds like promoting equality between Spaniards and indigenous peoples, right? But what it does, it just licenses endless Spanish intrusion and expansion. And so what starts out as what seems like harmless, like a right to travel, to sojourn or settle and preach the gospel, becomes a whole system of obligations, actually, that indigenous peoples are guaranteed to violate. And if they resist, and this is what's really important, they violate universal law. Any act of resistance becomes an act of war. And so that's where it's a no-win situation. So to give it a more concrete example, Vittoria says, if a community tries to keep outsiders out or expel them once they've entered, that act alone counts as war. So any indigenous attempt to resist Spanish presence, no matter how, just say, reasonable, automatically becomes aggression. So, and once resistance is framed as aggression, Spain is justified in defending itself. So every encounter becomes a pretext for retaliation. Every act of so-called defense expands Spanish control. And this is like the parallels here with Palestine are so clear, right? It's like resistance gets framed as aggression, yeah. And then, right? And then you have Israel justified in itself, and it becomes a moral actor in defending itself and further encroaching on Palestinian land, right? And yep. And this is where, like, the ties back to these questions become so important. Like, this is where that sovereignty doctrine takes place, right? And with that, like, even the authority to declare just war, which becomes a defining mark of sovereignty, saying, like, indigenous peoples can never legitimately wage war. They can never be sovereign. And this is theological. Right. And yes, like, is a sovereign's belief.
Right? How do you make an account? How do you have an account of when you hear things like Amalek, right? Those from the Zionist entity are saying things like, we must strike Amalek. We are the children of light and they are the children of darkness. And this war is in defense of quote unquote Western civilization. And I'm saying to people, believe them when they say that, all right? because it actually is. When we're saying that they are killing anybody who is up in resistance to land being taken, this has a greater history. That's theological as well, because again, why would you invoke the Bible in this? I'm sorry, in the Torah, right? They invoke the Torah oftentimes. So I really do appreciate you laying that out.
And then with that, right, like we know in terms of what's happening in Palestine is completely like underpinned and armed by the U.S. in particular with U.S. imperialism, and the ones really advancing those connections, they're framing those connections through the readings of the Bible, right? Like Christian nationalists and stuff, and they're not like even those at the centers of power within the upper echelons of the U.S. state. It's just like a lot of regular folks and their understanding of Christian theology and the way they'll read what's happening in Palestine, right? Like it's often in support, and it translates into a form of Zionism or like a confusion. Like they're not but it's what's saying like these are so deeply connected. And when people say, we've talked about this before, right? When people will sometimes say like Palestine has nothing to do with religion, it's like, no, it has a lot to do with religion. And if you want to say it has nothing to do with religion, and therefore this is not everybody, but sometimes people say like, we have to look to international law or international legal norms to think about these questions, like those themselves, as Vittoria and Angie is looking at, those themselves are completely steeped in and emerge from theological forms of power, right? And I think that's where it's really important to say, like the theological or the religious and the secular are not separate, right? And this is, I think this is where what's really important with Talal Assad's work, right? And this is where you're saying like the secular doesn't replace the religious, right? As a one worldview simply supersedes another. Really, the secular is historical configuration of religious concepts, practices, and sensibilities into new forms of authority.
Yeah. And so that's, and I can't wait for us to go into that more, because I think that's going to be a whole episode, because so many folks are talking about, you know, this question of after genocide, right? We want a quote unquote secular state. You hear this amongst activists. You hear this amongst people on the left, right? And I clutch my pearls when I hear this. I'm thinking, no, I don't want secular state. I don't want secularism. Secularism is what you have in France. And there's no mistake why they're so harsh against the hijab and so harsh against the niqab, right? That's not like a bug in the system. That's a feature of the system, right? That is the system working, secularism working, when we see what France has ushered in and other European far right countries at least have ushered in. So let's go to, I want to give you, do you have a last thought on Angie before we go to decolonial thought and world systems?
No, I think we went through.
Lovely.
Brilliant.
Okay, cool. So then now we have what is cited in the academy as the decolonial term. And I know people make a distinction between anti-imperialism, decolonization, decolonial thought. When I hear decolonial, I'm thinking of a particular emergence in the Latin American school that takes the question of 1492 seriously and talks about the kind of constitution of the modern subject, right? And then when we talk about world systems, we're talking about Gunda Frank, we're talking about Samir Amin, we're talking about Arighi and Walter Rodney and others, right? And it's also important that a lot of these, and Wallerstein, right? It's also important to note that a lot of the time when they're talking about world systems, just a point of knowledge, they're looking at the world from the vantage point of Africa as well. I think that's also important just to say when you think about the kind of what underpins and undergirds world systems and how it was made possible to emerge, right? It was from looking at history and the world from the vantage point of Africa. But for the purposes of our episode, how do you, I guess, use decolonial thought, world systems? What have you identified as the possible limitations when we're talking about the story of modernity from these perspectives?
Yeah, and this is where I think both traditions are really important, and I think they really help us think through these entanglements between like theology, imperialism, sovereignty, and modernity. I think they're looking at the same thing through different angles and slightly different lenses. And I think both traditions really help us unpack how power really operates through long durations. I think that's really key. So how categories like the human and sovereignty are made and remade, reconstituted, and they both really help reveal why the patterns set in motion before and after, like the discussion we had in Vittoria, still shape the political order we live in today. And I think, though, at the same time, is when I read them, and folks that are really deep into either one of these traditions or both, is, I mean, it takes a long time to work through them. Like, you listed a whole bunch of authors, right? Working through any one of these traditions, you can spend
your whole
life.
Course, I didn't. I never said to, that could be a whole encyclopedia, right? Working through all these people. But I think just to kind of, I guess, point it down a little bit or bring it down to our discussion So how does it kind of feature in your work, and how do you use these figures in trying to tell the story?
Yeah, and I think part, like, what you said was useful, and listing like all the different, the range and the wide spectrum of them, and then try to maybe like boil it down to some of the key features. And I think through my time working through them, my confusion in working through them for a lot of times, I kept thinking like, well, how do these theological sorts of questions and forms of power impact these processes, right? And I never thought, I didn't think either of them really took them sort of properly into account. So let's start with them. This is what you like sort of were asking, right? So decolonial thought, we can start with that. And so in its broadest sense, the tradition looks at how colonialism didn't just seize land, right? It reorganized knowledge itself. The knowledge question, or what's called like the epistemic question, becomes really important to decolonial folks. And one of the key figures for me is Annibal Quijano, and he called this the colonial matrix of power. So the notion of coloniality that he emphasizes is that there's no modernity without the colonial matrix of power, or what's called the CMP, and that corresponds to a global epistemic hierarchy. So that means we like the privileging of Western ways of knowing, being, and governing while making everything else seem local and particular, right? And so a concrete example of this would be like, you know, Malcolm's work and Fanon's work may be located in the Black Studies section of a library, but not in the philosophy section. Right. It's seen as particular, right? It's not seen to be universal in the same way that like you'd see Hegel or Locke or Plato. Mm-hmm. Like you wouldn't see them in a very particular strict section necessarily. They'd be in like philosophy, right? But seen as completely universal. And that's part of what decolonial folks are trying to think about. Like, how do different forms of thought get particularized? And how do others and other worldviews, in particular Europe, their worldview comes to stand in for the universal? And so another important figure here is Enrique Dussel, and there's many others, but Dussel is important. In his book, In the Inventions of the Americas, he argues that 1492, you know, the so-called discovery of the New World, and you alluded to this, it doesn't just mark the rise of European colonialism, but the birth of modern subjectivity itself, right? And so he shows how Western man comes to see himself as the center of the world, economically, politically, even spiritually, through the colonization of the Americas. And so when he says that 1492 is not a discovery, but an invention, he's making, I think, a really important point. Like the modern European I, the self that says, I think, I reason, I rule, was born through conquest. It's through the colonial encounter. And we need to remember that before 1492, like we mentioned, it wasn't the center of the world. It was marginal, late coming, and it was within a larger Mediterranean world, really still shaped by Islam, Africa, Asia, right? And Latin Christianity was really learning from others, right? It's really through the conquest of the Americas and the conquest of Andalus and the enslavement of indigenous and African peoples that the balance really shifts. And so what Dussel calls the European ego, this modern sense of self, emerged from moving from the margins to the center through domination. So Europe doesn't simply expand outward. It reinvents itself as the world's new axis of power and center of meaning. And Dussel mm-hmm. traces this through three main figures. So he'll trace it in his book through Columbus, Amerigo Vespucci, where we get the word America from, and Hernan Cortez. And for him, it's interesting, like each stage reveals how Europe remade the world and itself. And just to put it really succinctly for your listeners, Columbus invented, Vespucci discovers, and Cortez conquers, and they all together sort of form the hidden underside, what Mignola would call like the underside of the modern world. So when we speak about modern subjectivity, the European eye that grounds modern thought, we're really talking about a self-forging conquest. And so, I mean, for me, I think that's incredibly useful and important. And mm-hmm. but what struck me, and I'm curious to know what you think as well, is that I think most decolonial thinkers really focus their story in 1492 with the Americas, and how, at least for me, it be like a lot of mainstream decolonial folks that I've encountered often will focus on how the non-West is acted upon, right? And just to be fair, like Dussel mm-hmm. wants to talk about what he calls a planetary approach to examine how non-Western forms of thought were appropriated, but it's like that's often neglected. And so for me, like I really wanted to know what made 1492 possible in the first place. And when I did, I really came back to Andalus.
Absolutely. So that was, so okay, so that's the decolonial time. So now let's talk about world systems.
Yeah, so to really understand then again, like how 1492 becomes possible and how Europe really shifts from a marginal zone to the center of a global order, I think world systems analysis, I understand, is another tool, a really important tool. And I think in some senses it's broader and it centralizes the materiality of imperialism with a really strong analysis of capitalism, right? And I think decolonial thought, at least I think it's how it was developed and taken up, it really focuses more on the question of how coloniality reorganizes knowledge. They really focus on the epistemic question and often issues around representation, which I think frustrates a lot of folks who are more oriented toward a materialist analysis and more oriented towards world systems analysis, right? And so world systems analysis for me, I don't see it as being a necessary in opposition to decolonial thought, but I think it helped me zoom out in a really a better way to capture the material question of imperialism. So world system thinkers, and you alluded to them, like Arrighi, like Wallerstein, like really remind us that societies don't exist in isolation. I think that's one of the key, sort of simple but key insights that they provide. And they suggest that societies are part of really that's like larger networks of trade, power, and exchange that stretch across regions and then also stretches across centuries, right? So instead of treating Iberia or Africa, Asia, and the Americas as separate stories, world systems analysis like really helps us see how they're always already connected long before Europe imagined itself as universal. And then that brings you like really back into zooming out, and it could be a bit like overwhelming, right? But I think to really, for your listeners to understand what world systems analysis is fundamentally about, like I think there's two key ideas that really fundamentally mm-hmm. underpin it. And so the first is that history moves through cycles. Okay, so long ways of expansion and contraction. And Arrighi, he takes Marx's general formula of capital and he uses it to describe not only how individual capitalists invest, but how capitalism develops across centuries. And that's where he takes Marx's general formula of capital, like MCM prime, and then he applies it at like more of like a world systemic scale. Right? So he argues that each major epoch of capitalism begins with this long phase of material expansion. So you have large amounts of capital flow into trade, production, commerce, and sets more and more commodities into motion. But then that, when that phase begins to contract or runs into crisis, another phase emerges and you get financial expansion. So here, capital sets mm-hmm. itself free, as it were, from commodities, and it seeks profit through credit speculation, financial deals. And so for Arrighi, this financial movement really marks the maturity and typically the decline of a dominant capitalist power. And then this eventually gives way to a new cycle of accumulation led by a different center, right? So together you get these sort of systemic cycles of accumulation. And I think for me, that's really useful as having this sort of larger framework to understand a lot of these world historical processes, right? And then I think the second part that's important here is that these cycles are structured by hierarchy. Right. So core regions enrich themselves by exploiting peripheral ones. And over time, what happens is that these different powers rise and fall through these systemic cycles of accumulation that Arrighi lays out. And then what you have is that these patterns emerge where you have capital, power, and violence really migrate from one center to another. And he starts with the Italian city-states. For me, I think the Iberian empires are really important. Then he also moves to the Dutch, to the British, and later to the Americans. And so through this lens, I think world systems analysis just really makes the important claim that Christian Europe in the medieval period, again, it wasn't a world empire, as I mentioned. And the decolonial folks really take that up as well, right, to see that. And so I guess just to really put it simply, to put it maybe a little bit simply to bring these two together, is that what you have is that decolonial thought really helps us see how modernity or coloniality not only seized land, but extracted resources and exploited labor. Like now it didn't only serve that function, but it reorganized knowledge. And it really sought to erase or particularize other ways of knowing and being. World systems analysis, I think, can work with it to show how, you know, colonialism and imperialism really organized power and economic circuits across regions and centuries through cycles. But for me, it took a long time to work through these different frameworks.
Yeah.
And then when I came out the other end, and this is what I'm saying, where my research is currently lies, is that like, I think I think the theological question is really obscured or neglected. And so I wanted to, like, I don't know if I'm in an island here, but like, this is what I feel. I'm not sure if you have the same experience with that.
No, I agree with you. And I think that this is the importance of the work that you're doing, right? Because I do think the question of theology, and I think it's important because it's also back on the table again. I think after October the 7th, we're having these questions of theology again, and we're having about, you know, these notions of what we call, like, okay, if we want to bring about a socialist revolution, there's certain ideologies, certain practices, certain forms of relationality that have to be informed by something else that's not capital and neoliberalism. So that's why I think I think sometimes we can have a conversation about theology and people think it's like, you know, it's just theory or it's just abstract or it's just ideal. But I think what I'm hearing, the argument you're making, is that no, like, they are material processes and material impacts. The theology has a materiality to it as well. And I think that's important that we kind of ground that in this discussion. But then you've worked through this, and then theology is missing. So why is theology missing in these accounts?
Yeah, I think in part, I think there's something larger structuring, and this is what I think. There's a core thesis that runs throughout a lot of decolonial word systems analysis. I mean, some people may disagree, but I think there's the, like, religious decline thesis. And I think this is really like a core assumption. And I think this way of thinking really assumes that Christian or religious and secular ideas belong to separate worlds, that they're incompatible, and that as modernity develops, the secular naturally pushes religion out of public life, out of how we produce knowledge about life, governance, and economy. And so it often just becomes understood as like a moral justification or a moral veneer. And that's never been very satisfying for me, right? And so what I found is that, like, folks who do questions of epistemology really well, they don't focus on the material questions so much, and they don't typically have, like, the strongest, like, analysis of capitalism. And in a sense, they feel like the material question may subordinate the knowledge question, or an analysis of subject formation by focusing on the material question. And then in there, there's some room to think about theology, but I think it becomes captured by that religious decline thesis I mentioned. The idea as time goes on, like, the secular just sort of pushes it out of the way, instead of thinking about it how Talal Asad thinks about it, where the secular emerges through the reconfiguration of religious and theological discourses, right? And, and then with that, I think folks that do Marxist critiques of capitalism really well, like, they often don't do the question of epistemology maybe so well, but I think it's deeper. Like, they actually see this focus on epistemology as really obscuring the material question with the focus on identity and representation. And I think that's fair, but a different discussion. And I know when I do talk to folks that are more into, like, the epistemic question, like, they really do want to engage with the material question, but it is also a confusing terrain to work through as well, right? But I think, again, anyways, like, bringing these two together, I don't think they completely adequately decolonial and world system analysis. They don't necessarily see theology as a major force that really shaped the trajectories of imperialism, right? And I'm not saying they don't take it up, like, at all, because you have, like, Mignolo talking about the spiritual option. Dussel, I mean, he has a book, The Theological Metaphors of Marx, and he does think about theology, like Wallerstein, to an extent as well. But they haven't taken it up in a way that I see it being understood as really a constitutive force in shaping these dominant colonial capitalist relations. And then when you do, I think there's different questions that begin to get posed that may get sidelined, right? And that's where I would fall on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's again, we're trying to tell a complete picture of modernity. And I think if you don't focus or ground yourself in the theological, I think you have an incomplete analysis, if I'm being honest. So I do appreciate. So we're speaking about Al-Andalus, 1492, the expulsion of Muslims, right? And oftentimes when this is spoken about, we hear of this as the Reconquista, right? Europe taking what is rightfully theirs from these Saracens and these heathens, Muslims, right? And I know in your work and how you understand it, this is an invented term, right? That comes quite later. So I guess my question is, why? Two questions. Why is Reconquista historically false? And how does dismantling this myth change our understanding of Spain?
Yeah, that's such a key question. I think whenever anyone hears the term Reconquista, you need to challenge that term directly. Like it was invented in the 19th century to create a nationalist myth of Spain as eternally Christian. So it's really part of a nationalist discourse. And what it does is directly linked to Islam, because it imagines Islam as a foreign occupation, a real dark interruption between Visigothic Christianity and modern Spain. And that's not at all what happened, right? And when you reframe it and take it and contest the Reconquista framework, you get a different telling of the story, right? So what actually happens when we look at this through a different lens is that, you know, for three centuries after Rome's collapse, the Iberian Peninsula was ruled by what's Visigothic tribes, which basically like plundered through Europe from Germany and settled into the region. And in 589, the ruling elite, this is really important, they abandoned Arian Christianity. And Arian Christianity is a Unitarian theology that denied the Trinity. And so when King Ricaredo embraced the Nicene Creed and imposed Trinitarianism and formed a Christian kingdom with Toledo in its capital, it was really huge, because what it did, it aligned the Visigothic kingdom more closely with the broader Latin Christian idea. And so when, like, going back to that nationalist myth that emerges in like the 19th century, what's being done is an attempt to link this Western Latin Christian tradition with the Visigoths, and with that, their incursion into the Iberian Peninsula, right? And again, when they were Unitarian Christians to begin with, right? And the thing that's important too in the theological valency of this is that, like, there was already Jewish communities living within the Iberian Peninsula, right? And the Visigoths, like, they were brutal. Like, they denied their religious rights. Tens of thousands were forcibly converted to Christianity. And those who didn't were sometimes sold into slavery or with young children. I think usually like around 7 years old would be raised as Christians. And you have a series of different edicts in like the 690s that that articulate some of these things. And there's reports too of the Jewish communities revolting around 17 years before the Muslims even arrived. Right. And so with this, yeah, go ahead, Mamadou. Sorry.
No. I was just agreeing with you. And I was just saying that, yeah, please carry on.
Okay. Yeah. So when Tariq ibn Ziyad and his Berber army crossed the narrow strait in 711 from Morocco, they didn't like come in and wipe out a civilization. Like, there's a fundamental transformation. So this is where, again, contesting the notion of Reconquista, because it assumes that when the Muslims came in 711, that this was within itself a conquest. And this is where questioning that becomes really important. And what we see from the historical records, that really Islam spread through gradual conversion and political integration. It wasn't through mass invasion or forced conversion. So Andalus was really a fusion between Arab, Berber, Visigothic, Jewish, and Hispano-Roman peoples. And it became one of the most important centers of knowledge at the time. You had paved roads, hospitals, libraries, irrigation systems, translation schools. You had expert farmers and horticulturalists that I mentioned before. Like the Moors, as they were known, introduced novel agricultural techniques, introduced new crops like sugar, rice, lemon, silk, and coffee. And under the later Cordoban Caliphate, under like Jewish communities, like they experienced a remarkable flourishing. This is the time when you have like the Jewish Enlightenment. And so many, many Jewish people had like prominent roles in Muslim courts, including Samuel Haneged. And he was a poet and influential vizier of Granada. And David Wasserstein points out that the greatest Hebrew poets of the Middle Ages, Judah Halevi, Ibn Gabriel, Moses Ibn Ezra, they're all Iberian. And major Jewish thinkers such as Yehuda Halevi, and he's the author of the Kuzari, and Maimonides, who wrote the Guide for the Perplexed, they produced some of the most important works of Jewish philosophy in this period, in the Iberian period under Muslim rule, right? So when people talk about the so-called reconquest or reconquista, it's like a deliberate erasure of this truly multicultural Islamicate past, right? It's a real theological rewriting of history to claim purity and continuity. Right. And Charles Herskin, he wrote like an interesting book. It's like On the Feeling of History. And he's talking about the Iberian Peninsula. He was a student also of Talal Asad. And he talks about this as a myth of reconquest. And so what it does, it binds Spain's national unity to a really militant Catholicism. And it turns the expulsion of Muslims and Jews into a divine mandate, like a type of internal crusade. And that logic is what really travels later on to the Americas, right? And this is where, like, if you just focus on America's 1492, if you just focus on that, you're really gonna, you miss, again, what's leading up to it, right? Which is so key, like what's happening in Andalus.
Yep. And yeah, and to be fair, we've spoken on this podcast with Professor Zubair Y,
yeah,
on this question of what do you foreclose when you focus on 1492? And I think that's important that you raise that. So we also know that the figure of Alfonso the Tenth figures quite significantly in our thinking when thinking about these questions. But I guess for people who might not be familiar, I think people might have heard this name. They might have heard La Casas. They might have heard Vitoria, etc. And I think it's nice that we're actually laying out, okay, we're putting theory, ideas, knowledges to these figures. So I think in a similar vein, yeah, tell me about Alfonso X. What ideological world did Alfonso construct? And how do legal and theological codes intertwine?
Alfonso is a really fascinating character. And what it does, it's like really centuries before the final conquest of Granada. We got like Christian rulers in Iberia. They've really were working hard, and this connects to our discussion we just had, like really, really working to affirm the idea that only Visigothic Christians had a legitimate right to rule the peninsula. And what they had to do is like they have this crusading mindset. This is shaped again already by long traditions of anti-Muslim polemics. It was already really well established, right? And so by the 13th century, this sort of theology of hostility had been taken up maybe most aggressively by Alfonso, known as El Sabio or the Wise. And he's the king of Castile and Leon from 1252 to 1284. And this idea, like we see again, like just to make that quick parallel again to Palestine, like how much, like the enormous amount of like cultural productions that are put into trying to suggest that, trying to advance a Zionist narrative. Right at a cultural level, and we know obviously at the military, like material level, and this is like a parallel thing happening at the time when they're just doing everything they can to suggest that the Visigoths were the only rightful rulers, and that therefore they should expel the Muslims and Jews. Right. So what Alfonso does is he very openly frames Islam as a heretical affront to God. And he produces like texts that become quite popular. And one of the texts produced under his patronage, he writes that something to the effect like the Moors are people who believe in Muhammad and that he was a prophet, a messenger of God. But he says, actually, you know, the acts he performed didn't show the sanctity required of such a calling of a prophet. And his religion is essentially an insult to God. So he's very forthright in his really aggressive casting of Islam, right? So the political project is really clear. Like his strategy is to say, if Islam is illegitimate, then Muslim rule in Iberia must also be legitimate. And so he builds like an entire ideological program around this central claim. And that's where he commissions these really big works, the Historia de España, which is like a really big sweeping historical narrative. And then he also has like a book of laws called the Seven Divisions. And it's an enormous legal code that shaped Castilian law really for centuries. So he's working at like a cultural level with producing a history and then producing and articulating these ideas right into law itself. And within his historical account, he personally supervises this narrative and he weaves together Roman and Visigothic history in order to really justify his own authority. And he traces Spanish history from Noah's time to our own. And so this is what he's suggesting. He's recounting the Greeks, the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Vandals, the Visigoths, and then finally the Arabs. And the crucial move that he makes in his Historia de España is that he says only two of these dynasties, only two, the Romans and the Visigoths, are presented as legitimate rulers. All the others, especially the Carthaginians and the Arabs, are treated as invaders from Africa, as foreign intruders who violated the divine order by seizing Christian lands. And here, Alfonso inserts himself into the story, and he portrays himself as a living embodiment of both Roman emperor and Gothic king. He's the rightful heir to Iberia. By contrast, Islamic rule is cast not only as like foreign, but morally abject, heretical, and demonic. And then what ends up happening with this, it reflects like a broader Christian imperialist imagination. And what it's like, it, it, it the way it, the way this a particular form of Christian imperialism, I suppose, interpreted other religions, it's like Nelson Maldonado Torres, he says, like, Christianity often reduces Judaism to rigid legalism, right? And then Islam is reduced to pure violence. So what happens? You flatten out these traditions into these really one-dimensional characters, and he calls this a misguided phenomenology of religious experience, right? So in medieval Castilian thought, Judaism and Islam are not seen as rival traditions, but as corruptions and like even religious pollutants, right? And so he really, what he does is he directs like just an incredible amount of vitriol, particularly at Prophet Muhammad. And then what he tries to describe his death in humiliating fashion. He says he was obsessed with power and sensuality, and he's contrasting this with the Christ figure who scorns worldly temptation. And so what this does is that he's trying to say if like Muhammad is a fraud, then Islamic rule in Spain is fraudulent too. And it's not only at a cultural level. And you can see the strategy, right, Mamadou, like where he's, the way he's attacking it in a very particular way to create a particular cultural narrative around it, right? But what he does, he goes even deeper. Yeah, and he goes deeper, right? Because then in his Book of Laws, he takes those larger discursive or cultural ideas around Islam, and then he codifies it as both a type of military danger and like bio-religious threat. And so what it does, it ends up really culminating into laws around conversion and apostasy. And so 5 out of the 10 laws in this section deal with Christians who convert to Islam, and they could lose their property. They could be put to death. And then even after their death, they could still be accused 5 years later, up to 5 years later. And for those who convert to Islam and repent and return to Christianity, they face permanent civil like disabilities. They can't testify in court. They can't hold public office. They can't inherit property. And then sexual relations was another massive concern for him. So the idea is if a Muslim man slept with a Christian virgin or a widow, he would be stoned to death, and then she would lose half her possessions. If she was married, they would both be stoned to death. They'd both be executed. Yeah, but if a Christian man slept with the Muslim woman, there was no penalties. So the absence of legal punishment signals that such relations were tolerated, if not encouraged, right? There's like a clear asymmetry here, right? And what you have in this particular set of laws and ideas is that Christian women's bodies are guarded as the boundary of the community, what he's setting up, and Muslim women's bodies are not, right? And so what you have is Islam being defined as an existential like enemy, and position Christian Castile as the agent of divine restoration, right? So the idea where it comes out of cultural then into a legal language becomes important. And his idea of like invasion by diabolical Africans, especially like sets the stage for the triumphant return of Christian kings and the conversion of mosques back into, or masjids back into churches. And this becomes a really important symbolic reversal of Islamic rule, which I saw when I was in Granada, in that decolonial Islamic theology summer course in Granada around 2012. Like, you go into all these different churches and there's these really very violent histories, right, where they're built off the ruins of masjids and stuff, right? Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. I think that was brilliantly said, actually. Thank you for that. So we speak about different theories and understandings that privilege and place primacy on 1492 as inaugurating a particular modern world system. That's how it's taken up, at least. My question is to you, and I know it's quite broad, so you can take it in any direction you want. And the final question for today would be, what does 1492 signify for you, and what has it feature in your work, and what goes into, or what constitutes or precipitates 1492?
So when I think about 1492, like I think about the fall of Granada in particular. And it's like in the same year where you have the fall of Granada, and then you have Columbus, right, which we'll talk about next time. So, I mean, maybe, yeah, we like to unpack that a little bit with the fall of Granada, because it's so key, right? So once Castile and Aragon decide that the Iberian Peninsula can never be whole while Granada remain Muslim, what happens? The conquest takes on a really different urgency and intensification. So by the mid-15th century or so, it had become really like a political, military, and deeply theological project. And then the two figures, Ferdinand and Isabel in particular, they frame it, you know, as a divine mission, something that will restore Spain, unify Christendom, and cleanse the land of what they described as the last remnants of Islamic rule. And so they go full throttle, and the final war begins really in 1482 with the capture of Alhama. And so for your listeners, Alhama was a key fortified town near Granada that controlled key routes into the kingdom. And when they captured in 1482, this really cuts off Granada from like really the rest of the different principalities. And it was a sign that things were quite irreversible. And what ends up happening is that you have a simultaneous set of different things happening. Like you have a crusade, you have a strategy for territorial expansion and plunder, and a wave of popular Christian migrations into formerly Islamic lands. And so all these processes really reshape the emerging Spanish state. And that's like 1492, indexing sort of the emergence of the Spanish state in this way becomes really important for me as well. And so with the rise of these different armies and the rise of a nascent state, there's a real huge push also for religious reform. And this is where I think a lot of listeners would be at least aware of things like the Inquisition. And a central figure here is he's a Franciscan as opposed to a Dominican. He's a Cardinal Francisco Jimenez de Cisneros. And he was Archbishop of Toledo. He was the Inquisitor General. And he really embodied sort of how theology and power fused together in late medieval Spain. And what he does, he really intensifies conversion and doctrinal purity. And he really targets Jews and Muslims through new catechisms, surveillance, coercion. And this is really fascinating for many different reasons, because it has like an interesting backstory. Because for centuries in particular, Jews in Spain, they held really important roles in finance, commerce, and administration. And what happens around the 13th and 14th century and onward is that their status really declines really sharply. And part of this was tied to economic crisis, right? But much of it grew out of Christian anxieties around money lending, right? So the church, and a lot of people don't know, is that the church really banned Christians from charging interest, which is something fundamental, like in the Islamic tradition, right? And before they rooted this interpretation in parts of Luke. And it was reinforced in church councils. And so what happened is that a lot of Christians were really relying on Jewish moneylenders. And this is where you get this, like, partly this, all these stereotypes emerging around Jews, right? In Europe in particular. And then you get like this first caricature of like the stereotypical Jewish person with a hook nose showing up in like 13th century in an English tax receipt, I believe, right? So it was the Christians like using them in this way, right? But what it did is that their dependence on them, because Christians were using them as money lenders because it was theologically sanctioned in their eyes, it turned into like deep resentment and violence, right? And so by the 13th and 14th century, you have like massive riots and forced conversions spread across Castile. You have like synagogues destroyed, and you have these things happening. And then what you have is they force them to convert, and these converts are known as conversos. And they often rose in really high political and even ecclesiastical positions in the church. But it really, and this is going to be really important when we think about Las Casas, there's this like really this fear in the air about these false converts, that people just converted just to save their own skins, but they're working against the dominant sort of political order. And so the Muslims, they end up facing something very similar. And so there's the same thing. What you have is this deep suspicion and fear of Muslims already nurtured, like I mentioned, through years, Crusades, Alfonso, etc. And what you have after 1480 is you get the Spanish Inquisition. And they really turn their attention to conversos, which are the Jews that converted, and Moriscos, Muslims who converted. And they accuse them of secretly practicing Islam and Judaism, right? And so the thing that's important, I think, to clarify is the jurisdiction of the Inquisition was really reserved for Christians, and it punished heresy and apostasy, but its main function was to go after these, what were called like crypto Muslims and crypto Jews. And they also even went after some Catholic mystic orders. So when they're doing this, a lot of decolonial folks will often read around this moment. So like the doctrine of purity of blood, or limpieza de sangre, is that you have this purity of blood discourse. And so some decolonial folks would be like, this is the origins of modern bio-racism. And I don't think it was. Like, what it really was to distinguish old Christians from those with like Muslim and Jewish ancestry. So it wasn't racial in a modern biological sense. It was like genealogical, linking Christian identity to the Visigoths and their Latin heritage, right? But it had really, really, really brutal consequences. And so just sort of to round out like the importance of some of these things that were happening when Ferdinand and Isabella enter Granada, right? This is ending nearly 8 centuries, right? Like 800 years of Muslim rule in the city. And that same year, they issued the Edict of Expulsion, ordering all Jews to convert or leave Spain. And so you have maybe 150,000 to 200,000 Jews were expelled. More were converted. And those who fled, and this is really important, like they were welcomed in the Ottoman Empire. And the sultans recognized their economic and intellectual value. And others dispersed across North Africa and Southern Europe. And the ones that went into Southern Europe, like they just like the account, like they just faced continued expulsions and forced baptisms as opposed to what they faced in Ottoman Muslim lands, right? The thing that's really interesting too is Jacques Derrida, right? Like he traces his lineage to Andalus, where his family eventually ends up in Algeria. And this really shapes the method of post-structuralism, which has come to have like a really huge influence on post-colonial theory. And then a lot of decolonial Marxist folks like love to hate post-structuralism in particular, but like it has this really interesting backstory, right, to it.
That will be another episode in which we discuss post-structuralism. That'll be another one. We'll do one on post-structuralism. I think the way you explain it is, I think you were describing me that I have a bit of a antagonistic relationship to it. But when I've heard it from you, I think you might have semi-converted me. So,
sometimes I'll bring it up for fun too. Like with some Marxists I know, I'm like, oh, like you want to hear about post-structuralism? And I'll see their face literally like cringe up.
No, but sorry, I cut you off. Please finish your point. And then please, I want to, in the last couple minutes that we have left, please finish your point. And also, if you want to leave listeners with like 3 or 4 things that they take from this episode, what would they be?
Yeah. Okay, cool. So talking about, you have this, what happened to Jewish folks in Iberia, and then they get expelled. So thinking about what happened to Muslims, right? So Cisneros, this figure that I talked about, he was like really frustrated with what he saw as slow voluntary conversion, right? So he orchestrates mass forced baptisms, and he boasts of converting thousands in a single day. Thousands of Muslims in a single day. And then those who resisted faced exile, their dispossession, or the Inquisition. And so by the end of the 15th century, the Muslim population was about like over 5 million in earlier centuries. And it had been reduced to a few hundred thousand by that time. This is like millions and millions of people forced to be converted, killed, exiled, right? And so in regions like Aragon, Moriscos made up over 90% of those targeted by the Inquisition. Right. So when we talk about the fall of Granada, we're talking about much more than a military victory. It was really like a multi-century project. It was a theological purification of Iberia, the consolidation and emergence of state power, and then really a violent restructuring of society through conversion, exile, and surveillance. And like all of these would really create the ideological, discursive, and administrative machinery. It basically like the blueprint that Spain would really carry into the Americas. Right. So 1492. What happens is like it's not the end of one history. It is really the blueprint for what comes next in the Americas, right? And that's where when I say like reading decolonial folks and the way in which it just like Americas just sort of pops in as this key moment, which it is, I don't think you could really quite grasp the importance, the theological character of it as well, without really understanding what was happening beforehand, right? And then I guess just like really briefly, there's a few other things, like 3 months after Granada fell. So this is in 1492, this is in April, right? The crown signs the capitulations of Santa Fe, granting Columbus like these extraordinary privileges for a westward voyage. And a few months later, he sets sail in October, he lands in what would be known as the Americas, right? And what he called like the Indies. So for Spain, this is like not a break of the past. Like this is an extension of a sort of crusading imagination. And the thing that's really interesting is that Spain was actually going to go what they wanted to do is they wanted to push their like crusade across into North Africa. And their goal initially actually was to outflank Islam and secure the southern flank of Iberia and extend Christian rule into the Mediterranean, like into Morocco and North Africa. That was what they were going to do. And they actually launched a whole bunch of different expeditions. And it looked like in a moment in history that North Africa was going to be Spain's like next frontier. And then that changed like dramatically, because once the news of Columbus came back to the crown, their entire geopolitical horizon completely shifted. Like the so-called New World promised like so much, I guess, more. Like North Africa for them, it promised prestige, but not that much wealth. The Americas, right, the so-called New World, like it promised like silver, land, and essentially souls, right? And so America became a much more fruitful field of like empire, like a place where Spain could continue its crusade, accumulate wealth, and spread the gospel. And what really emerges from this is that when you get like conversion, conquest, and capital become fused in this system, right? And this is where Columbus sort of becomes a hinge, right? And so that's really key to thinking about some of these processes and what could have happened at one point historically, right? And so for your final question, Mamadou, sorry, like
I'm not rambling on too much in each section. No, please. This is a masterclass, guys.
Okay.
Listen, guys, surround yourselves with people who are smarter than you. You see what you get? So carry on, please.
No, thank you, bro. So what we get, I think some of the main takeaways, right? It's like, look, the conquest of Andalus, it was not a reconquest. And it was not just a chapter in medieval history. It's really the blueprint, I think, for Western imperialism. It taught really like Europe how to conquer in God's name and how to fuse salvation with sovereignty. And that logic, it really didn't stop in Granada, right? When we're talking about the fall of Andalus and the expulsion of Muslims and Jews from Spain, like this deeply theological. And when they expelled particularly the Muslims from Spain, like they expelled all of their expert agricultural expertise. And that's what Dussel and other writers and also Wallerstein say, like Spain completely, I guess, short-circuited its ability to develop as an industrial power. And we'll talk about that sort of next time in the next podcast, because the expulsion of these different communities, it wasn't just like in terms of its anti-Islamic and anti-Jewish character. Like it did something like fundamental to its economy, right? And its place within the emerging world economy, world colonial capitalist economy, because Spain ends up completely falling behind, right? And so we'll talk, like all the consequences of this are just going to be quite profound and major. Yeah.
No, but I think this is a great introduction. I know it's for the listeners, I know it's a longer than usual episode, but I think given the kind of complex nature of these histories that we're marshalling, that Professor Zahir Kolia has marshalled, require this length of episode. But I will end it here. Okay, I know we have number 2 and 3, but I think you laid out a brilliant introductory episode to our topic. So guys, I would highly recommend engaging with Professor Zahir Kolia's work, which you will, and I get to know him. Please check him out online, check what he's written as well, and then you'll be hearing more from him. So thank you once again, Professor. I look forward to speaking to you again, and take care.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.